You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As we learned last week when Michael Kirk was here to discuss the first of a two-part series called The United States of Secrets, the Bush administration launched what came to be known as the program in the aftermath of 9/11. It instituted mass surveillance, and President Obama has expanded it. But how does the NSA get all the data carried by Google, AT&T, and others? In the second part of this investigation, Martin Smith examines the relationship between the NSA and Silicon Valley. It airs tonight as part of PBS's Frontline series, and I'm very pleased that it brings Martin Smith back to our show today. Hello.
Good to be back.
Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Justice charged five Chinese Army personnel with cyber spying. If they were doing so under legal Chinese government authority, wouldn't they have been doing much of the same sort of thing that the United States has been doing?
Well, that's the whole thing about the Internet. It's never before have we put so much information out there, has so much been collected. And it's not only available to the government, but it's available to hackers. It's available to foreign governments. It's really available to anybody with the know-how of how to get in to your computer, inject malware in there, take over the operation of your computer. They can see your keystrokes. They can know your passwords. So, yeah, anybody – really, there's nothing that the private sector can collect that government can't come along and get or a hacker can't get.
Well, some have called for independence from the American Internet backbone. Do we know how American officials think that would affect American interests?
Well, already the companies in Silicon Valley are saying they're going to lose billions of dollars if that happens. It's really hard to get your head around how that would work. The Internet is really designed as one unitary system where everything is syncing up constantly with all the data centers around the world. So these ideas of somehow building a wall, in China now, people that know how to do it can access things that are censored by the Chinese government by going outside, connecting to the world's internet. But how you're going to sort of fence off portions of the internet from others, I don't get it.
Well, Vladimir Putin has called the internet a CIA project, and he has suggested creating a separate one.
Well, good luck. There's a lot of things that...
But does he have a valid point there? Because it really was created in the United States by something
by the Defense Department.
The Defense Department. And as a result, everything has to go through the United States.
Well, because we were first to the table. That's true. A lot of things go through the United States. But the way it works now, if you have a computer at home and a computer at your office, anytime you make a change at the office, you know, if you've got it linked up with a cloud somewhere, it changes at home. And if you multiply that out over the whole internet, you've got all these data centers around the world, thousands of them, and they're all syncing up. We make a keystroke here, it changes there. So it's all one big redundant system, if you will.
How important to the NSA was the cooperation of American companies like Verizon or AT&T? Could the NSA have conducted its surveillance without their help?
Well, they wouldn't. I mean, they get from these phone companies not only the so-called metadata, these phone records, who you called and when. General Hayden has recently commented about the collection of metadata and saying, you know, we've killed people based on metadata. This is very potent information. They like to say, well, you know, it doesn't have the content of the call. But in fact, they do collect the content of the call and can tap into it when they want. But the important point is that these phone companies also provide the internet backbone. And those companies, there's evidence there that we now know that they have provided access to the government to tap into that internet data that they handle.
How much can we trust what Michael Hayden says in the first show in this series? He's often caught lying.
Well, you know, that's...
Or fudging the facts, at least.
Yeah. Well, they're in a difficult spot. They're trying to protect the secrecy of the programs. I mean, the whole point of what Snowden has done is that we have, as a democracy, a conversation about things that have been held secret. And this is anathema to what Michael Hayden and others at the NSA wanted to happen. As one person says in this program that's going to air tonight, we didn't design our programs thinking that they would ever be exposed.
Professor Tim Wu of Columbia University charges that AT&T, Verizon, and other telecom firms think of themselves as in a partnership with the U.S. government, and he calls them faithful handmaidens of the government's will. What did the telecoms do?
Well, yes, it's an elegant little phrase, faithful handmaidens of the government's will.
You must have been pleased when he said that on camera.
Well, he's a quite eloquent guy who knows a lot about the phone companies. The phone companies have been in a partnership with the government for many, many years. They depend on the government for right away for their telephone lines across the country. They're like a utility. They require a lot of cooperation from government, so therefore they have been in partnership for a long time. And after 9/11, they really offered whatever help they could give to the government in providing access to the data that they were handling. And again, that's not just phone calls, but that's a lot of internet data as well.
In the congressional testimony that appears in your film, AT&T's Edward Whitaker seems completely intransigent under questioning from Senator Arlen Specter. Have other telecom executives been more open?
I think that Sprint, which is controlled by a Japanese concern, has tried to resist to some degree. This is recent information that's just come out. But by and large, they're under gag orders, and they're by and large not able to really speak openly. So what you saw with the CEO, Whitaker of AT&T, in his testimony in 2006 was complete stonewalling of Arlen Specter's questions.
And when you went to these people, did they stonewall you as well?
Absolutely, 100%. We approached all the major internet companies, because that was our primary focus, and all of them to a T, after many requests and some meetings with a few of them, said that they wouldn't speak. That was a big surprise to us and a real obstacle, or let me say challenge. It's never there's never a program that that you can't make just because somebody won't agree to talk.
Well, how does that work for some of the company like Google, which says it doesn't want to do any harm and presents itself as a kind of idealistic company?
This was in their mission statement,
yeah.
Do no evil. And this comes up time and time again, and I guess they rue the day that they came out with that. How does that work? Look, these companies profess that they hold their users' privacy foremost, that they believe in transparency, that they really are just interested in organizing, in Google's case, the world's information and making it freely accessible. The other side of the coin here, and it was kind of a revelation to me, I just haven't thought about it, that Google is really an advertising company. That 95% of their revenue comes from advertising. And to be a good advertiser, you have to be good at surveillance, because you have to figure out what your customers want. What are their intents? What are their preferences? And so they're in the surveillance business, so they can sell the information about their users to advertisers.
Well, everybody does that. Newspapers would say, this is our demographic, and you want to place your ad on page 4 because you want to reach a certain kind of an audience as opposed to page 12.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody has always done that. Television does that. But never have they had such sophisticated tools for doing that. The search box, just to take the most basic example, not only do they know the demographic of people, but they know their intent. Because when you put in there that you want to go looking for an iPhone, they know that you're going to buy an iPhone. They know your intent to go buy that. So as one of the interviewees makes the point, it maps very nicely with advertisers' need to get in front of people who have a certain desire.
And although this isn't in your film, we've heard in the past about how Target started sending information about clothes and other things for pregnant women to a family, and the family was outraged until they realized that their daughter was pregnant.
You know, there's so
and that,
much.
That was all because of the things that she was looking for on the store's online presence. You know,
yeah,
the
your whole browsing history is now saved. In the beginning, they were saying they weren't going to do that. But now all that information is saved. We don't know exactly how long. And these privacy policies, if you ever try to read them, you'll be spending I think it's estimated if you read all the privacy policies of all the companies that you interact with, it would take you about 180 hours. And I think it would take you another 200 hours to try to understand what you just read.
Well, often we get a little, this really tiny type and pages and pages. And then at the end, after we've stopped reading, we say, I accept. And I don't
even
know what I'm accepting.
I don't think most of us even read it. I think it's
number
three font, and we just say accept, which happens to be in a large font.
Martin Smith is my guest. We're talking about a program that is part of the PBS Frontline series. It will be on PBS stations tonight, called The United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans. You interviewed a former employee of AT&T, Mark Klein. Wasn't he a whistleblower in 2006, long before the Snowden leaks?
You know, there were a number of whistleblowers inside the NSA, as we learned in part one last week on United States of Secrets. There were very few people from the private sector side, but Mark Klein was one of the first people to witness things that were very disturbing for him. And he witnessed a secret room, a door with no door handles. He traced the wires. He found out that there was a splitter and it was siphoning off traffic. He had a lot of reasons to suspect this was an NSA operation. But he didn't speak out because he was near retirement and he didn't want to lose it, so he was scared. He didn't speak out until 2005, or I think it was 2005 or 2006.
Well, that's when we talked about it on the show.
Yeah.
And we thought that this was a major revelation, and yet it came and went.
It came and went because the Snowden revelations provided documentation. And all the whistleblowers inside the NSA and the very few private sector people had no documentation that this kind of dragnet bulk surveillance of both telephone calls and internet traffic was going on. So Snowden, you had a lot of people running around and people just said that was the tinfoil hat crowd of paranoids. When Snowden came along, a lot of those people that were accused of wearing tinfoil hats were declared correct.
The Washington Post's Barton Gellman says that the NSA was collecting a very large fraction of the whole planet's internet traffic. When he says a large fraction, what does that mean? Over half?
We don't know. I mean, the whole time I was doing this, I felt like it had been handled a jigsaw puzzle, and a lot of pieces were missing. And we're still – the story is still unraveling. And there's all these thousands of documents that are highly technical that are still being perused by Bart Gellman, for one, and others. So we don't know exactly how much information was being taken in, but we know it was a lot, and that the programs that were deemed to be narrow and targeted were less narrow and targeted than we were being told.
Well, when Gellman was first ready to publish his story, the government asked him to withhold the names of the companies.
Yeah, that's an indication how radioactive those associations are, and those companies, you know, are one of the strongest parts of our economy.
But don't we know who they are?
Well, we do now, and that's because they published the names. That's because the Gellman and the Post decided to go ahead. They didn't see that as a risk to national security, and so they went ahead and published those stories.
Well, what impact has there been on AT&T or Google or Facebook in the aftermath of news that about their role in government spying?
I don't know about AT&T, but I know that the internet companies are saying they're facing billions of dollars in losses, and especially if they see companies or their branches overseas being restricted. The whole internet depends on user trust. And if people around the globe, especially around the globe, because that's where the growth is for these companies. The United States is now a mature market. They're not making a lot of new they're not finding a lot of new users. But overseas, they're hoping to continue to grow. And if those people think that, you know, if you're especially if you're, say, an activist in Egypt or the Ukraine, do you want to go on the internet when you know that somebody can be getting that information and using it against you? They're worried, and they suspect that they're going to lose billions of dollars.
And actually, that's happened in some countries like Turkey.
Of course it has, yes.
My guest is Martin Smith, the second part of a two-part series on the United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans, will be broadcast tonight as part of PBS's Frontline series. It goes on at 9 o'clock tonight?
10 o'clock in New York, but check your, 10 o'clock in New York.
And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Martin Smith, who's responsible for the second part of a two-part series, a Frontline series called The United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans. The first part was mostly about the NSA, and this is about the internet or the spying in general, which connects commercial entities with the government and sometimes in partnership.
Yeah, the first part was about the legal and political decision-making process that took place over many years following 9/11 that led to what's called the program. And what we looked at was the other side of the mirror, if you will, which is the private sector and their collaboration with government spying and their unwitting, the tapping of their data without their knowledge.
Initially, President Obama downplayed surveillance, saying that the program didn't look at names or content, didn't apply to U.S. citizens or people in the United States. Was he lying, or do you think he just hadn't been told the complete story at that point?
I like to think that he wasn't fully briefed. The fact is, we don't know what his NSA chiefs told him, but we know that the program is targeting foreign terrorists. But the fact is that a lot more is collected, and therefore they're able to put together and dive into large collections of data that contain American information. So there's a lot of spillage, and you can't really divide up the internet into foreign and American users. It's all blended together.
One of the programs revealed through Snowden was called PRISM. Can you describe PRISM for us?
Yeah, PRISM was a kind of front door program whereby the government would identify through the use of what are called selectors. They had 45,000 selectors approximately that they would then go to Google, Facebook, Yahoo, Microsoft, Apple, AOL. There were 9 internet companies that participated in PRISM. They would go to these companies and say, we're interested in anything you have related to this selector. Selector was a name, an email address.
The word jihad.
It wasn't words so much as I understand it. It wasn't like fertilizer bomb. Mm-hmm. It wasn't jihad or, some other such thing. But it was mostly identifiers. And then the companies would then provide them access to a Dropbox with that information that they would put up there, or they would give them a hard drive. It depended on the company and the technology. But it was witting. They knew. The companies knew, although only a few people at a given company would know about the program. They had to have a top-level security clearance. And so that program continues, and the president's panel has judged these kinds of programs as being useful.
There seems to be a divide between the people who run these companies and the people who work for them. Do we have any sense of how employees are reacting to learning about things like PRISM or another program that I'm going to ask you about, Muscular?
Well, Muscular is very different than PRISM in that Muscular was the tapping of overseas data lines, again, where all your information and my information is flowing without the company's knowledge. So as Eric Schmidt of Google said, they didn't call, they didn't write, they didn't knock, they just took. So that really felt like a betrayal to them of what they had signed up for through PRISM. And there is a great divide. The engineers felt that they were doing sufficient amount of encryption. It was proven to be inadequate. Some companies did almost no encryption prior to the release of the story in the Washington Post in October of last year. Google had thought they'd done a pretty good job of encryption, but even they were caught unaware.
And they may prevent backdoor intrusions, but will they still comply with national security letters?
National security letters came under fire by the president's panel when they released their report in December of last year. And national security letters were, in their estimation, being abused, used too often. National security letters are used in the early stages of an investigation, and under the Patriot Act, they were allowed to be issued by any FBI office in the country without a judge's review, with very little oversight, and tens of thousands. Between 2003 and 2006, there was something close to 200,000 of these letters issued. And they often came with gag orders, meaning if I laid one on you, you couldn't talk about it, and it wasn't even clear if you could call your lawyer. The most amazing thing about these tens of thousands of requests for information was that the companies complied.
Although Google finally challenged some of the NSLs it received last year.
But they get 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 of these over a period of time, and they challenge 19?
Mm-hmm.
It's not – I mean, it's not – the constitutionality of these letters was brought into question not by a major internet company with deep pockets and resources and lawyers. It was brought up by a small internet operator who was a web hosting outfit in New York, a guy named Nick Merrill. At Calix. And he was the first guy to fight this. And in fact, the courts ruled his gag order unconstitutional. And he wasn't opposed to giving information if there was a legitimate warrant issued and a court signed off on it. But this was simply an FBI letter saying, we want this information from one of your clients. He refused to do it. He never gave up that information, fought for years, and won.
Although the FBI ordered him to keep the letter secret. But Google and Facebook have pioneered ways to track people. Has the NSA learned any techniques for gathering data from private firms like that?
As I think I was saying in the earlier segment, they're in the surveillance business, right? Anytime you go on a site, you're being watched by scores of other companies, advertising companies of one kind or another. And they all drop cookies on your machine, and these cookies track your behavior subsequently.
Can't you erase the cookies?
You can erase the cookies. A lot of people don't know even how to do that. And you can block certain cookies. But they're coming up with technology that's unlike cookies. They're pixels, other techniques. What we found out, or what Snowden revealed, and what Bart Gellman and a colleague of his, Ashton Soltani at the Washington Post, were able to figure out was from the Snowden leaks that the government was piggybacking on these cookies. So the government could get in there and inject malware into your computer, watch your keystrokes, get your password, do whatever they needed, because they were using the commercial surveillance technology for their own intelligence work.
But defendants will say they're not doing that to me because they have nothing to learn from me. They're only doing that to the bad guys.
Well, that's the idea. And they have – look, I'm not saying that the government should shut down its efforts to keep us secure, but there's a balance here. And all that Snowden came forward to say was that he wanted to have a discussion, that he was thwarted in his efforts to bring this to people's attention. They're not coming after you, but it's possible that you could be identified as what's known as a false positive. And there have been abuses in our history. J. Edgar Hoover was trying to blackmail Martin Luther King, famously. There are other examples of this kind of abuse. The NSA has had to fire a couple of its employees because they were reading the emails of their girlfriends. Do you want the government to have a list of every time a person, you know, a list of everybody that's called a gun shop or an abortion clinic or a suicide hotline? It can be abused, maybe not by this government. Maybe you like this president. Maybe it's another president in the future.
But we willingly reveal all sorts of things on places like Facebook. And Professor Chris Hufnagel of Berkeley says that his friends at the FBI love Facebook.
You know, I think we're addicted. I think that we know maybe this isn't all good for us, but we're addicted to the connectivity. You know, and every time somebody goes and looks at their phone, they're seeking sort of some affirmation, some love, if you will. And it's very addictive. We all know that. But are we thinking long and hard enough about just what we're giving up and why?
You interviewed James Hopkins cryptography professor Matthew Green. After the Snowden reports, Green blogged about how NSA spying could subvert cryptography worldwide, and the university asked him to take down the blog post. Are critics of the Obama administration's policies coming under pressure?
Well, they were in the case of Matthew Green. We don't know how many people are being put under pressure. We know that in the case of the discovery that the NSA was using cookie technology to learn about targets' behavior, that when they called Google, Google fought back. So we know that Google had tried to discredit one of the reporters.
At the Washington Post.
At the Washington Post. So it's not just the NSA.
So people are doing self-policing here.
Well, it's not just the NSA that wants to keep information hushed up. It's the private sector. They don't want their commercial surveillance work to be associated with government spying.
Last week, Senators Mark Udall and Ron Wyden charged that President Obama has created a culture of misinformation about domestic surveillance. Has Silicon Valley been honest, or has it had a role in creating this culture of misinformation?
You know, I wish I could speak more. I wish I'd had some cooperation from the companies in Silicon Valley. I have to say that these are companies that depend on the trust of their users. They say they protect privacy. They won't speak to these issues in what is, in our programs, a responsible public forum. And I think it's really a shame.
Stuart Baker, who's a former Bush official, accuses Snowden of, quote, quite deliberately causing as much damage to U.S. companies and the U.S. national interest as he can. Is that view widespread in the U.S. government?
I think there are plenty of people who, not just in the government but at large, who feel like the government has done a good job of protecting us and therefore what Snowden is doing is just trouble. I mean, the polls don't show that people are up in arms about all of this. I think, however, we're just learning the full scope of the story. I don't know.
Well, I mentioned earlier that we have been hearing similar things before Snowden over the years. In some cases, we were prevented from hearing them, like James Risen's story, which the New York Times killed for a whole year and only finally published after he wound up writing a book. Now
and after the election,
and that was an important consideration. But I don't know whether that would have changed the election result. Whether President Bush wouldn't have won re-election if James Risen's book had been published earlier. But still, it seems to me that even with the Snowden revelations, we are very much a country divided as to whether we want to know about this and what we should make of it. What kind of response has Frontline gotten from these two shows?
It's been tremendous in terms of people being appreciative of having it all pulled together and synthesized and told, with the participation, I have to add, of many people inside the NSA, inside the White House, inside the establishment who agreed to talk. Again, the Silicon Valley companies were mute on the subject, but I think that a lot of people have shown great appreciation and feel like they, for the first time, really understand the history, the context, just what has happened. I wanted to point out that Snowden, you know, Baker accuses him of doing great damage to the United States. Snowden didn't release anything publicly. What he did is he contacted some journalists that he trusted, and he gave them documents. We don't know how many. And he said it was up to them to use their judgment as to what to publish. And those journalists have been very careful to make sure that what they publish doesn't compromise a source, doesn't jeopardize an operation, doesn't do damage to national security. And they publish stuff that helps us understand the scope of this so we can have a national discussion. But they're not out there to do damage to the United States.
Well, Glenn Greenwald Barton, Gelman, and others continue to report on those documents and the surveillance programs, but the government is also continuing to develop new techniques.
Well, the cat's out of the bag, right? We don't know the full extent. They're also trying to develop the technology that would break any kind of encryption that exists, which means that that's the end of privacy. When you have all these banks depending on private transactions, secure from being tapped, and you have the government working on a quantum computer that can tap into that information, I mean, we're really in a tug of war between security and privacy.
Michael Hayden says that if Americans want to restrict the security community, there might be costs. Couldn't that argument also be made about democracy itself?
Well, you know, his job was to collect information.
In the first show, we see that he first questioned the order that came from Dick Cheney. But then when he realized that he was being given carte blanche, he jumped in wholeheartedly.
Well, in a way, that's Michael Hayden's job, is to collect information. You can argue whether or not he should have wear a policy hat and make decisions about protecting privacy and getting the balance right. But finally, that decision, it seems, I mean, this is my opinion, but it comes to the president and to the Congress and to the courts to decide just where the breaks should be. So I think that what happened in this case is that the Congress didn't seem to be fully aware of the extent of these programs, and and perhaps the executive branch had gone too far and there were no checks.
And then there were people like Dianne Feinstein who were very strongly in support of, and then discovered that maybe she was also being spied on.
You know, it's a real question as to whether or not the people that were briefed in the intelligence committees on Capitol Hill were sufficient as representatives of the rest of us for judging whether or not this is where we want to go as a democracy.
The European Court of Justice has ruled that individuals have a right to be forgotten and that Google should allow online users to be forgotten by erasing links to web pages. Is that part of a European backlash against American spying?
Yeah, I think very much so. But, you know, that's also – there's no First Amendment lawyer in the United States who doesn't currently lose sleep over such a ruling. And there's no tech executive who isn't really worried about how to get his head around how we're going to have a different internet in Germany or the Netherlands than we're having in the U.S. And do you really – I mean, this is a very difficult question.
On the other hand, the case involved somebody who was being dogged by something that had happened many, many years ago, and it just kept on popping up as one of the first things when you Googled his name.
Well, you know, there was a case with Eric Schmidt where he had Googled his name when he was at when he was not long after he arrived at Google. And he didn't like what came up, so he called Sergey Brin and Larry Page into his office, and he talked to him about it. And they said, "Sorry, that's the way it works. You're going to have to live with it."
Even funnier is Philip Roth was upset by a Wikipedia entry that gave the sources of his novel, The Human Stain. He said it wasn't true. He corrected it. They re-corrected it, went back to the original because he didn't have any corroborating witness to prove that what he had said was true.
Yeah, well, we're
he is the writer.
He is the writer. You'd think
they have my birth date wrong, and I'm not going to correct it. Totally wrong. I don't know where they came up with
don't you
May 9th.
It?
Well, because somebody will switch it back to May 9th or whatever.
I was in there as winning an award that I never won, so I corrected it.
Well, I'm going to give you an award right now, Martin. If you
okay,
want me,
Leonard.
We'll talk about you won the Nobel Prize, and it's going to appear in your next Wikipedia entry.
I didn't know about that. That's great news.
Martin Smith of the United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans. The second part of the PBS Frontline series will be broadcast tonight here in New York at 10 o'clock. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Leonard, it's always a pleasure to be here.